And I feel like the Peltoncast Fantasy League is the happy talk and making fun of you.
It's not really making fun of me. I made the finals in two of the three leagues that I was in. It's more making fun of you. So I don't.
But you didn't end up winning. I don't call myself fantasy genius. So,
making the finals in two-thirds. Just start the podcast.
Hello and welcome to episode 190 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Boulevard Park, Washington, the home of the Peltoncast. This is our last Boulevard Park podcast for a while, probably.
TBD. We'll you never know.
We always do it over the holidays, though.
The Marcus Tubbs edition.
You're not going to go with the Steve Entman edition?
Steve Entman edition, sure.
Sure, if you're into that sort of thing.
New Year's Day is kind of Steve Entman's day.
It really is.
In a lot of ways. So we'll give the nod to Steve Entman. And a Happy New Year to everybody out there. Thank you for joining us for another year of the Peltoncast.
We're into our second decade now.
Wow.
Think about that.
Yeah.
We're also coming up. We're not too far away from episode 200. So start thinking of your favorite highlights
from of the last 100 episodes.
Episodes 101 through 200. We are drinking today. Once again, we've been going to this a lot lately.
Rainier.
Rainier.
I was not going to drink, but then there was a Rainier sitting here and then.
You went that hard at your New Year's Eve last night?
No, it was just, you know, it's like it's the afternoon. It's New Year's Day.
It's going to be 5 o'clock by the end of this podcast. So we have some toast to get to.
Mm.
We did not cover this on a previous podcast. But the Peltoncast Fantasy Football Leagues wrapped up in Week 16. The highlight of Week 16 that was otherwise marred by the Seahawks' loss to the Cardinals. And it's imperative that we give a toast to our champions, especially because none of them are you. None of them are me either. Yeah.
You put it. Especially because none of them are you.
In the Peltoncast Champions League, we had the honor Oakhawks, led by friend of the pod, Glenn Christie, all the way from London.
Wow.
Beating the Ramblin' Rumspringa of self-proclaimed fantasy genius Jibber, who was a little hasty, perhaps, in about attaching that designation
fantasy
to himself.
Fantasy genius Jimmer, but the alliteration is worth it.
It is.
We had, Jimmer lives in Omaha.
I believe so.
In the Peltoncast Champions League, we had an international championship, and a person from England won. American football.
That's true.
I'm impressed.
Isn't that, well, you know, if you listen to the Peltoncast, you get such a strong knowledge of, and nowhere else could you glean that on the internet, but listening to the Peltoncast.
If I understand time zones correctly, most of the NFL Sunday happens in London overnight.
I don't know if I'd say most of it. Most of the Seahawks games are probably pretty late.
No, they're probably like 8 p.m. actually. Because 10 a.m. is 5 p.m. in London.
Something like that.
But that's Monday. Right? No.
No, they're not in Asia. I mean, there are time zones.
Podcast time zones.
Oh, jeez.
Wow, I thought we were kind of at perfect time for football in Seattle, but having the games, every game be a primetime game, your game starting at 5 and 8 p.m. is actually not bad.
It's got some merits. Now, the night game starting at then, if it,
11?
This is assuming this is correct. Yeah, but it's a three-hour game.
Still.
Okay.
It's not bad. I'm just going to say.
You're moving to London?
Yeah.
That's what you're declaring right here.
Anyway, congrats to Glenn Christie. I mean, winning the Peltoncast Champions League. And being from London, you understand what Champions League means.
True. None of us all got it. In the Peltoncast.
The current Champions League champion is from London, and the Peltoncast Champions League champion is, from England.
Yeah, I don't know if that checks out.
Not London. Doesn't England have the Champions League trophy?
Yes, they do.
Yeah, plus the Peltoncast Champions League. Wow, equal honors.
Yes. The Peltoncast Economist Friends League. Shoddy's football dive bar, Chad Markson, beat There, No Thanks of Jesse Offenhearts. So toast to Chad. In Peltoncast, home of the Super Bowl 48 champs, where Tristan made the final, Talking Taco Time came up short in the final against Tom Brady, is a system QB, and Lukey Crowley, friend of the pod.
Then in that same week, I guess this is actually week 17, Tom Brady was proven to be less than a system QB.
Some system QB.
He was a system QB for about 15 years, and now he's below replacement level and the week following. And can I just say, Saquon Barkley having precisely one good fantasy week. I mean, I guess it's impressive that if you drafted Saquon with the first pick that you made the finals.
Yeah, because let me tell you, my team that had Saquon did not make the finals.
It was just like, we had such a monster Lamar performance.
Also, weirdly, did not win week 17 with that team in the consolation, or week 16, I guess. He did not win week 16 in the consolation bracket, despite even the monster Saquon game. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I had my lineup complete at that point. I did come up with...
When is your lineup going to be complete?
I came up with a solid... No, I mean, like, I don't know if I paid attention to my lineup in that league for fifth place. I did pull out third place victories in both of my leagues where
that's,
I lost.
That's what you actually call a championship.
It's the tradition.
It's winning the third place game.
It's like Arsenal getting the championship by getting the fourth and final spot.
You win the Northwest Championship. You know, it's all that anybody's really actually cheering for.
It is. Lastly, Totem's Country, the Seattle Prospects, and James Darnbrook.
Another Brit?
Yeah, seemed like did some things wrong, Austin Hine.
Man, this is like American action films.
And also, while we're here, of course, congratulations to the famous cousin Katie for winning our Friends and Family League, beating you in the final. And the best part of this is that you thought you had won. We're talking trash throughout the afternoon
about
it. Taking
a victory lap.
And then I looked at the scoreboard and realized... Hey, you actually lost. I was just curious to see whether my third place score, how it compared to your first place score. And it turned out that it wasn't a first place score at all.
Jared Goff freaking went off. And look, you know, if you want to win a fantasy league with players like Tyler Higbee on your team, it's not for me. But if you want to do it, Katie, that's totally fine. You know, if you just don't care about the quality of humans that you have on your fantasy team, then so be it.
Wow. I feel like we need to have Katie on to defend herself after this.
You're dunking on me about this when I was in three fantasy leagues and made the finals in two of them, and you're over here just being like,
I'm just saying, I don't call myself a fantasy genius. Also, number one in points in two of my three leagues. That's what I'm really playing for, is the regular season.
You're confused. We don't do this British soccer style.
We do it 90s Sonic style. Great regular season, losing the first round of the playoffs. Yeah, that's what I'm going for.
You may be confused about how this works. And it's no coincidence that, let me say this again. And it is a coincidence that the two teams that I took to the finals just so happened to have Lamar Jackson as their quarterback.
Weird. Well, amazing how that worked.
But you didn't draft Lamar Jackson in any leagues, did you?
Dak Prescott worked out so well for like 13 weeks.
Yeah, the Dak train really fell apart.
Although I did get his solid week 17 in our week 17 Friends and Family, like, in the third place game. Let's move on though to our NBA Seattle update, sponsored by Pagliacci Pizza.
Because Pagliacci wants basketball back in Seattle, and so do we.
A few different directions we could take this week. Do we want to talk about Gary Payton II?
Sure.
He's a star now.
Is he really?
A star is strong. But...
a star is born.
But now a really solid NBA player.
Wait,
for
really?
The Washington Wizards.
Really? I could not have named.
We should have done who he played for.
Yeah.
So they signed him out of the G League. Did we mention this on the pod last week that I had interviewed Gary Payton at the G League showcase the day before he got called up?
I don't think you did. Wait, he's been a star for how many days now?
Oh, like a solid week and a half.
He's like a Jeremy Lin level star.
I mean, they're starting in Isaiah Thomas, Gary Payton II backcourt
right
now.
Wow.
With Bradley Beal and small forward. It's an incredible thing for the Northwest.
That's going to be a real roaring 20s for basketball players from Seattle.
So his first game, he's coming off the bench. He flew in the day before. 34 minutes, 10 points, 11 rebounds, 5 assists, 6 steals.
There we go.
His second game, 10 points, 5 rebounds, 5 assists in 31 minutes. And then starts his third game, 15 points, 6 rebounds, 6 steals.
Wow.
Then in his next game, his superstardom went to Garrison Matthews, Jordan McRae, and Jan Mahinmi, who all had big games in that win for the Wizards. So
he was distributing.
His contract, they have to decide on whether they're going to keep him for the rest of the season by January 7th, which is when all contracts guaranteed. And he's currently there on an injury hardship exception. So they can't his contract can't guarantee if he's the 16th player on the roster, but they can cut someone else and keep him in that spot.
Is there any chance that they wouldn't keep him?
It seems unlikely they wouldn't, given how big a role he's playing right now. They can waive Justin Robinson, who's a rookie backup point guard for them.
I mean, he's starting right away.
Yeah. I mean, the other alternative is then they could waive him and then sign him to a hardship 10-day, but they are going to get some players back at some point.
So you had a situation where you interviewed both Kobe Carl and Gary Payton II.
That's correct. A story about how Kobe Carl was coaching Gary Payton II in the G League with the LA Defenders.
What was their impression of this? Did they note that it was interesting?
Yeah, they noted that it was interesting.
Okay.
The thing about GP2 is he's not a big talker.
Uh-huh.
Neither of them are as vocal as their parents are.
Sure.
It's fair to say, but particularly GP2. So I didn't get it. With him, it was just kind of more reminiscing about his childhood and his memories of Key Arena. Kobe Carl went a little deeper on what it's like to be the child of this famous person in your profession and, you know, how they kind of have that in common and that sort of bond.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is that Kobe Carl is going to be a head coach of a team soon and turn them around quickly.
Yeah, perhaps so.
You're not willing to go that far?
I don't know if he's going to be a head coach soon. I mean, he's considered one of the more promising coaches in the G League, but, you know, it's kind of random how that happens. So I don't know that. So I was originally going to write this as a story for ESPN. That was my plan. I hadn't pitched it to them. Now that Carl isn't actually coaching Peyton anymore, it may not work as a story, and it may end up a PeltonCast feature.
Oh, can't hello. Rule that out. It's a peek behind the curtain.
Do you want to talk about the Blazers at all?
Is there Blazer stuff to talk about?
It's not great. They had another big man get injured when I was there on Saturday.
Wait, really?
Scott LaBissière.
Oh, he's hurt too?
He started that game against the Lakers because they wanted more size. They pushed Carmelo Anthony out to small forward. And then 2 minutes into the game, Scott hurt his knee. And we haven't heard an update yet, but he did not accompany them on their East Coast road trip. So, not great. Blazers centers. It's a dangerous occupation.
Are the Blazers, should they still be competing for the playoffs?
Probably.
They're not in a place where they should just tank.
I mean, they were the 8th seed at that point. They have subsequently fallen behind San Antonio a game back, but nobody's running away with that 8th seed. I mean,
the bottom of the West is just so bad.
Yes. I think any time, you know, it's probably worth it to make the playoffs. They will get Nurkic back at some point. Sounds like maybe sooner rather than later, maybe really? In the month of January.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
They still may try to do something by the trade deadline.
If they're getting Nurkic back by January, does that make you think that the whole brash offseason move
for Hassan Whiteside?
Yeah, to trade for Hassan Whiteside doesn't make any sense.
Well, I think what it then means is that you've got Hassan Whiteside as a $26 million expiring contract, and it makes him overwhelmingly likely to get traded.
Okay, so then if Nurk comes back, they flip Hassan for something fairly valuable.
We'll see how valuable.
Kevin Love valuable?
He's definitely a consideration. Yeah, I mean, you're not going to get that for Hassan Whiteside straight up. You're probably going to have to throw something into the deal.
What about a three-way trade, though? Somebody who wants an because the Cavs don't.
No, they just take the expiring contract.
And just have cap space?
Have even more cap space.
Wouldn't they want a pick, though, if another team wanted to get in the mix that cared about an expiring more?
I mean, perhaps.
Are there not teams that are like desperate for cap room for this offseason in the same way that there have been in the past?
There really aren't, because there's just not that many players on the free agent market this summer.
Because every single player changed teams last summer?
Exactly.
Who are the top free agents who are like realistic going to change teams or be available?
So Anthony Davis is not realistically going to change teams. After him, I mean, there's some good restricted free agents.
AD ain't signing in Cleveland.
Yes. But Brandon Ingram is a restricted free agent. He'll be really interesting to teams. But the top unrestricted free agent, I mean, off the top of my head, I'm not sure, but it's this Davis Bertans. It's like in the conversation.
It's going to be a fun mock-off season.
Yeah, it's going to be a very different mock-off season than yours. I mean, there are a lot of interesting restrictions.
Davis Bertans.
Well, first off, Davis Bertans is really good. We haven't seen him
in
GP2
together. Gary Payton II is out there. He's a legit star in this past 4 days. Whew.
Well, there you go. Quick update on the Seattle Sounders, who saw center back Roman Torres sign with expansion club Inter Miami. Correctly navigated that one this time. Sounders still negotiating with their other starting center back from the MLS Cup champion team, Kim Keehee. Will add a center back if they can't re-sign him, someone to play alongside Javier Arriaga, who we've all expected to become the starter next year. UW men's basketball, since we last discussed them, has completed the Diamond Head Classic in Honolulu, a 72-61 win on Monday against host Hawaii in their first and only true road game of the non-conference schedule, and then on Christmas night, a 75-71 loss in the championship to Houston. Not a terribly surprising result, but disappointing in terms of it was a game that was very winnable for the Huskies that they led much of the way.
Much of the way? I mean, it was pretty close for the last
it was
quarter
close.
Of the game. I think that...
That's still much of the way.
But sure. We knew the Huskies were going to lose this game.
I don't know if we knew they were going to lose this game. We knew that they were underdogs in this game. They were... Even though they were ranked...
10, though, it was just like...
Yeah, they shot the ball really well in the first
Houston
half.
Houston is going to come back. I mean, Houston, the Huskies were lucky in the first half in three-point shooting. Houston was lucky in the second half in three-point shooting. It all evened out, and it was a pretty close game. And the Huskies had chances in the last minute to tie it up.
Yeah. Jaden McDaniels couldn't come up with a rebound as he was looking to push the ball. They were down two at that point. Would have been a great opportunity for them to potentially take the lead. But, you know, that's how it goes. Houston, a wildly underrated team. They came in ranked 30th in KenPom, and yet even after this win over a ranked Husky team, still distant in the also receiving votes in the rankings this week. People sleeping on what Houston is doing. They're 27th now in KenPom.
Wow.
The Huskies slipped to 29th in the AP poll, fourth among the also receiving votes, and they are 26th, the first team out, tied with Utah State, who they beat last year in the NCAA tournament in the coaches' poll. But a chance to improve those rankings this weekend.
When I think before then, it makes sense, non-conference play is now over, to take a step back and sort of get a sense of where the Huskies are going into conference play, both just as a team quality-wise and then also national perception-wise. Do we have bracketology yet?
There are various updates.
We have Joe Lenardi's bracketology.
He didn't update after the championship game of the Diamond Head Classic.
Where were they at before then, though?
Well, that was what was surprising. I went and looked at this, and I figured they'd be like a 7. And instead, they were a 10 before this.
Ouch.
And so most of the projections that have come out since then, the ones that have updated since then, have the Huskies in average of 10 or 11. So on the fringe of the at-larges, which I figured it would be more in line with their rankings, which would put them somewhere in the range of 7.
Bracketology is getting smarter than the rankings.
That may be the case. That is very plausible. Let's see. It looks like there are a number who have... Now, some of these, I looked at bracketmatrix.com that aggregates these, and some of these are, in fact, driven by statistical projections, but the most recent runs, pretty much all have them is a 10 or an 11. Some 8s in there.
Whew, okay. That's kind of worse than I expected.
Same.
I was under the impression that they'd be not comfortably in, but that they'd... 7-8, somewhere in that range,
right,
being a top 25 ranked team.
Yeah, and especially it was a good non-conference for the Pac-12. Got some marquee wins. It feels like, the Pac-12 is still the weakest, certainly, of the power conferences in college basketball, but not by the same kind of dramatic margin that we saw last year. Not in, and I think last year they dropped behind the American. Yeah, they did on KenPom. This year they are in fact 6th.
Yeah, take that, American.
You throw out the records when you're talking about the American
conference. Pac-12 is back, baby.
So I still think that the selection committee is going to want to reward teams in major conferences that played reasonably, they played a reasonably difficult non-conference schedule. But that also matches up with, I looked at their net rating, which is what the NCAA now uses in place of RPI. They're 43 there, so that also puts them around the 11 line of the rankings.
Okay, and then what about just as a team on the court? Because to me, they're a different team than they were entering the season, and potentially even in those first games in Alaska.
Because of Quad A Green's emergence?
And just the team in general looks different. You know, we were expecting a lot from Naz Carter going in.
That's true.
And Naz Carter is a more distant option on offense. You know, I think if we were to had to rank basically the offensive options, Naz was one or two at the start of the season.
Right.
And now I think he's fallen to three or four.
Which he probably should be ahead of Jaden McDaniels, even though McDaniels is a better playmaker. I mean, he's just been a dramatically more efficient scorer. Well, not dramatically. He's been a more efficient scorer.
Jaden's definitely had some moments where he's looked much better throughout non-conference play, though. You know, I think he was a little clueless right at the beginning, especially on offense. And given more time playing against the speed of, you know, NCAA basketball versus high school, he's looked a lot better. Isaiah Stewart has definitely been, maybe not a surprise, but has definitely exceeded expectations offensively.
Yeah, he's been even better than I thought. I mean, I thought he would be certainly the best of the freshmen and probably the best player on the team. He's been, you know, it'll be interesting to see when he goes up against more teams with size and teams, you know, teams that are game planning for him a little bit more. You're going to see teams multiple times now in Pac-12 play, which obviously you don't in non-conference. So those will be some interesting challenges for Isaiah Stewart, but he is ready for them.
And then Quade Green has sort of emerged as getting closer to the type of player that we were expecting him to be. He's able to shoot a little bit more and better than he was at the beginning of the season.
I mean, shooting 46% on threes. If you were expecting better than that, 56% on twos, which surprises me given that he's sometimes had a difficult time finishing against size. Probably, you know, primarily shooting around the basket. But he's been awesome. He's been everything you could have hoped for, I would say.
And we, during Pac-12 play, should want to see more of Quade Green. We should want to see the ball in his hands more often, him shooting more often, and looking to create for himself.
Yeah, and I think that's been gradually happening. Like, he's been ramping up his involvement over the course of the season. I think one interesting thing to watch is whether Jamal Bey starts to supplant Hamir Wright a little bit. I think that, you know, Hamir Wright's length is very valuable in the zone. Having him on the one wing and Jaden McDaniels on the other makes it difficult for opponents to score, but he's shooting 27.5% on threes, has only made 5 2-pointers all season. Jamal Bey just provides a little more scoring punch in that spot, and you know, even though he's not statistically going to come up with the blocks on defense that Hamir Wright does, he does lead the team in steal rate with a top 50 rate nationally. So I feel more comfortable personally when Jamal Bey is out there at small forward instead of Hamir Wright, and it'll be interesting to see if, you know, the coaching staff eventually starts to agree with that.
Absolutely. And then, so what about these games to start the Pac-12 season?
I mean, I think the other question is probably what kind of record do the Huskies need to make the NCAA tournament? And based on what we've seen from that, it might be closer to 12-6 than 10-8.
Oh, my God.
I mean, I think that's possible. KenPom has them going 11-7.
I think that's enough.
It puts them on the border. Now, that's the fourth best projection. Part of it is that, you know, in practice, you're going to have more spread in the standings than you do in the projections. If they finish top four in the conference, they're probably fine as long as they don't stumble badly in the Pac-12 tournament, which you really couldn't if you were the fourth seed since you'd get a bye. So I think that fourth, top four spot is crucial for them.
Okay.
All right, this weekend they will host the LA schools. UCLA, who I happened to see in person in Las Vegas as they were taking on North Carolina, went 7-6 in non-conference play under their new head coach, Mick Cronin. They lost their last three non-conference games, including a home loss to number 274 in the KenPom rankings, Cal State Fullerton. So not great times in Westwood. Have dropped to 127th themselves in KenPom, 10th in the Pac-12. They're ranked number 199 in defensive rating, partially because opponents are shooting 40% on threes. But UCLA itself can't shoot at all. They're 321st in three-point attempt rate and making just 30% of their threes. They do have a lot of size in the front court. That's probably the one strength of this team. And then freshman Tiger Campbell and Jaime Jaquez have shown promise, but still not particularly efficient at this stage of their career. I think they're, you know, players that are going to be come on for UCLA later on. They're certainly not one and done types, but being asked to do a bit too much at this stage of their career.
And so UCLA is one of the worst teams in the Pac-12 right now.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is pretty crazy.
Ahead of Cal, and I think they're still ahead of Wazoo, despite the fact that Wazoo probably had a better non-conference season than they did. Yeah, just ahead of Wazoo.
So we should be expecting the Huskies to start Pac-12 play with a victory on Thursday night.
If it's not a comfortable win, then yeah, they've underachieved in this game.
Okay, and what about USC?
USC presents a much bigger challenge. They went 11-2 in non-conference. Their two losses at home to Temple and then on a neutral site against Marquette in the I think that's the ESPN, the Worldwide Sports Classic or something like that. Disney's Wide World of Sports Classic, I think, is that one. They have not necessarily, they also have some pretty good non-conference wins. They beat LSU at the Staples Center. They beat TCU in what was effectively a road game. Got Harvard in a neutral site as part of that tournament and then won at Nevada. So those are all top 100 teams wins for them. But still, their rating has dropped partially because of the fact that they have had relatively close games against weak opponents, including in their last game, they beat Andy Enfield's former team, Florida Gulf Coast, which suffice it to say is not Dunk City anymore, by just 13 points. But a big reason for that is that their star freshman, Onyeka Okongwu, who has emerged as a lottery prospect for this year's NBA draft, missed that game with an ankle sprain. He's considered day-to-day going forward. He's shooting 64% on twos, strong rebounder, and he's in the top 20 nationally in block rate. So obviously very important for them to get him back. USC hold the opponents with that strong interior defense to 43% on two-point attempts. They don't shoot many threes, but have shot them at a decent 35% clip. I think if you're the Huskies looking at this game, you need to make their freshman point guard, Ethan Anderson, shoot. He's got a top 20 assist rate nationally, but is shooting just 34% on twos and 31% on threes. So he really wants to play make first and shoot second.
What does that mean in a zone, though?
I guess the
zone is not designed to make any individual player shoot.
But it's to take away. But it is designed to take away his dribble penetration opportunities and, you know, prevent him from being able to
distribute.
Get you in rotation and create open shots for teammates.
So this could be a game between two lottery big men.
Yes.
Both freshmen.
I'd expect to see a lot of scouts at this one.
Interesting.
I mean, you've got three lottery picks as freshmen in all likelihood.
You're counting Jaden?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, Jaden's the most likely lottery pick of them all. Okongwu is probably the most uncertain. Stewart, in between, given, you know, he is a center and the devaluing of them. Not that I had anything to do with that. But he's done everything he could at the college level to prove his value.
This is all your fault.
Don't tell Isaiah Stewart.
Send all hate mail to Boulevard Park, care of Kevin Pelton, Isaiah Stewart.
But no, this will, I would expect a lot of West Coast based scouts will be at this game. That's going to be probably the marquee scouting game of the day, in all likelihood.
And what are the Huskies' percentage chances of winning this one and starting the Pac-12 season 2-0?
KenPom gives them about a 70% chance of winning it.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Because they're a better team, and then home court advantage, that combination.
Does that still exist in college basketball?
It does. It's declining, but it does still exist.
Okay. More on that later.
We're going to get back into that. UW women's basketball started Pac-12 play last weekend. They start a week earlier because their tournament is a week earlier. Got a 65-56 win at Washington State to kick off their conference schedule in much better fashion than last season when they finished 2-15 in conference play. So already halfway to that total. And 9-3 overall so far. This weekend, a much tougher task as they head to the Bay Area to take on the Bay Area schools. Cal went 8-3 in non-conference play under new head coach Sharman Smith, who was an inaugural member of the Storm. She took the job this year after their longtime coach Lindsey Gottlieb became an assistant for the Cleveland Cavaliers. Cal's three losses came to ranked opponents, so they're still a solid team, even though perhaps not as good as they've been in years past. Stanford is 11-1 and ranked number 5 in the country. They had actually reached number 1 before losing on December 22nd at Texas and have 3 wins over ranked opponents. So, as usual, a tough task for any team going into Maples Pavilion to play Tara Vandeveer's squad. UW football, the update this week, primarily on NFL draft decisions. We've got word from 3 Husky prospects. Of course, Jacob Eason, as everyone surely heard by this point, is headed to the NFL. Lost that bold prediction.
You're so stupid. You knew he was going to the NFL. Have you seen how tall and how white he is? And how big-armed? I'm just telling you, like, we knew what was coming there.
I have seen them. But on the defensive side, both Elijah Molden and Levi Onzerike announced that they will be coming back for their senior seasons. We still await word on...
Not huge surprises there, but nice to have them back.
Yeah. We still await word on Savon Ahmed as to what his decision is going to be for his senior season.
And this team next year is going to need to be a team driven by the defense. be pretty fascinated to see what Jimmy Lake does.
And perhaps the running game.
Yeah. Well, I mean, quarterback is the biggest question mark on the entire team next season.
Yeah, sure is.
So, you know, they were lucky to have Jacob Eason for a year, but it means that with Jimmy Lake coming back, and I would assume that Coach Pete probably had a sense that Jacob Eason was leaving as well.
Yeah, I don't think this is a surprise to anyone.
That, you know, the options are pretty unproven, right? It's between Dylan Morris, Jacob Sermon. Like
Jacob Sermon, whose three passes are the most of anyone on the roster. So there has been a lot of speculation. I don't know whether there's any merit to this about the possibility of the Huskies actually going the grad transfer route with KJ Costello.
I mean, if KJ Costello comes here, they're Pac-12 North favorites instantly.
Historically, it has been extremely difficult for the Huskies to get grad transfers because those players have to qualify as any transfer student would, as opposed to, you know, there are different standards if you're coming in as a freshman as part of the athletic department. So that's why, that, you know, while you see Oregon and Gonzaga in particular load up on grad transfers in basketball, where these are more prominent, and then also Oregon kind of started this trend, I think, to some extent. I guess Russell Wilson was a grad transfer when he went to Wisconsin.
Absolutely, he was.
He was one of the first, but Oregon...
And the first Wisconsin-Oregon Rose Bowl.
Yes. Oregon added, I forget who the quarterback was, who was a grad transfer, but they ordered a couple.
The dude from...
Well, the,
from
not,
Eastern.
Not Vernon Adams, but even before him, they had added someone from, like, Mississippi or something.
Their quarterback.
Jeremiah Masoli, maybe?
He transferred to Mississippi.
Oh, is that what happened?
Yeah.
I don't know, but they added someone before. Vernon Adams wasn't the first one, and they had Dakota Brewcop.
What is there any way for those rules to be changed? Like, what is the... Where is that coming from? Is that coming from the school? Is that coming from the athletic department?
It's from the euphemistic upper campus.
Oh, upper campus. Mm.
The same people preventing them from selling beer throughout Husky Stadium.
And those are the people who made the mistake of letting the both of us in. I came in as a transfer student also.
It was a different time when we made it in.
Was it? I guess it was a pretty long time ago.
Yeah, they let in students from the state of Washington back then.
Oh. Well, that KJ Costello will fit in fine.
I mean, one does think that KJ Costello could be an exception coming from Stanford. Like, he's got a better chance of making it as a transfer than your typical grad transfer option.
They let Tim Morris in. So we would assume...
Tim Morris wasn't a grad transfer.
But he transferred from Stanford, too.
He did, yes.
You would assume that Jen Cohen is already fighting for this. This is something that Jen Cohen wants.
I think that is a reasonable assumption.
Are there other schools around the country who have this problem?
I haven't looked into that. I would not be surprised if it affected some of the UC schools as well. Like Cal probably does not add a lot of grad transfers.
Why?
Well, academic standards are a little different here than they are at the University of Oregon.
But I'm just telling you, I talked about this like 2 weeks ago. Look, I've seen the U.S. News and World Report rankings.
Oh, no.
They're not that good.
The U.S. News and World Report.
Just, I think I had this exact same complaint. Let in transfers, right? You're already plummeting in the U.S. News and the World Report.
Those two transfers per year are going to just cause them to go down even further.
It's a ridiculous perspective. Like, I mean, especially once players start being able to monetize their names, like, we're moving farther and farther away from college athletes being treated exactly the same as, well, actually, they actually are being treated the same as regular students by being able to monetize their name. But it's just like some of the restrictions are thawing a little tiny bit.
But this, again, is not an NCAA thing. It's a University of Washington academic thing.
But so basically what you're saying is that UW is not competing on the same playing field as most of their opponents.
Not in terms of transfers, no.
And transfers are becoming a hugely important thing for major college football programs.
I wouldn't say a hugely important thing. They're becoming a tool for college football programs.
I mean, we saw how many consecutive Heisman Trophy finalists and runners-up.
I mean, and the Huskies have had transfers. It's not. It's more the grad transfer in particular that has been very difficult.
What
for
is
them
the
to
difference
do.
Between those things?
That I don't. I could not explain.
Who was the last transfer Husky football got?
I don't remember off the top of my head, but basketball has had a number of transfers.
Some. I mean, Quad A obviously being a big one.
Yeah.
But
Robert Upshaw.
But like, Can you think of a single one that Husky football has gotten?
It was like some cornerback who transferred here from Alabama, I think.
When was that?
And he was not, as it turns out, particularly good.
But we had Joe Burrow. I mean, he wasn't a grad transfer, but Joe Burrow wins the Heisman. Baker Mayfield won the Heisman.
It was Kyler Murray, yeah.
And he was not at Oklahoma the whole time?
He started at Texas Tech.
Oh, he was also at Texas Tech before going to Oklahoma.
He definitely transferred.
What the hell? Right? So, like, is Jimmy, like, able to go out there and aggressively pursue a player like KJ Costello?
Tough for me to say in an individual case.
I mean, could there be... I mean, obviously, there are probably better opportunities out there for KJ. He could go be the quarterback of LSU or something, right? Like, there are better opportunities out there.
He will have plenty of choices.
But UW is still a pretty good choice for a quarterback like KJ Costello.
Yeah.
I mean, he'd be staying on the West
Coast. Kyler Murray was at A&M, to correct that. A&M.
So that's three consecutive Heisman Trophy winners.
Yes.
Who all transferred to another school. And UW has gotten some guy from Alabama.
They also got, fun fact, you know who transferred to UW?
Who?
Jacob Eason.
Yeah, that we couldn't come up with that one. Okay, fine.
He did not win the Heisman.
How did he get in, though? What was the difference? Because he wasn't a grad transfer?
I don't know. I can see an argument where, because of the fact that a student has multiple years left, it's, you know, there's more value to the UW in admitting that person as a transfer than there is with 1 year remaining. That's a pretty uncommon thing, I would assume.
If you're a grad transfer, he's graduated from Stanford.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's the difficulty of getting to the graduate programs at UW as opposed to the undergraduate school.
And so that's what you'd have to do, is apply to a graduate program?
I think you have to apply to a specific graduate program.
Really?
Yes.
Hmm.
And originally it had to be something you didn't have at your school, but I think they got rid of that at some point.
Okay. Well, one would hope that there is a potential for a quarterback. I mean, there are a lot of quarterbacks transferring this offseason and every offseason.
I mean, and we also don't have a good sense for how good Jacob Sermon and Dylan Morris are. We haven't seen them basically at all during games. I would have liked to have seen more Sermon action this year in some blowouts.
But there weren't blowouts.
I mean, there were some blowouts where he just didn't play until the very end of the game. The coaching staff will have a better idea of what they have on hand than we will. And then the other aspect of it is Ethan Garber's coming in, will be part of spring camp. He could contend to start as a true freshman, as we saw with Jake Browning.
Yeah, I would say it's totally wide open, though.
It is very wide open.
But between those three quarterbacks or somebody else, it's going to be an interesting offseason. I mean, we've heard Jimmy Lake talking about wanting to be aggressive. And I think what that means is in every facet he's going to, you know, do the due diligence and have those conversations with players like KJ Costello.
Yep.
So it'll be pretty interesting to see where he ends up.
Masoli was a grad transfer, but yeah, you're right. It was from Oregon to Ole Miss. Let's move on to the Seahawks. We'd already discussed in our emergency pod on Sunday night their 26-21 loss to San Francisco. Any lingering thoughts from this? Pete Carroll implied at practice on Wednesday that the NFL had told him that they should have called pass interference on the Jacob Hollister play.
Cool.
Yeah. Very helpful. So we took a very brief look at this week's opponent, the Philadelphia Eagles, but now we'll give a more extended preview, starting with an update on injuries, which loom large in this matchup in particular in the playoffs. For the Seahawks, we learned on Monday morning that Michael Kendricks tore his ACL when he left the game on Sunday night and is obviously done for the season, and an injury that that could linger into the start of the 2020 campaign. Quandre Diggs may be the biggest player to watch this week. Carroll said on Monday, trainers are saying he's going to be back, and he was able to practice in a limited fashion on Wednesday, but told reporters we'll see about playing in the game on Sunday. We'll see if it was like when I am upset about something or like, you know, I think something but disagree with you, and I'm like, huh, we'll see.
We'll see. Yeah, we'll just see.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, we'll always see.
We probably will see.
By definition, we're going to see.
So
that's the one that figures to have the most impact on the game, other than possibly Dwayne Brown, who Carroll said is going for it this week. But
Dwayne Brown's not playing.
That would be a very quick turnaround from his surgery, less than 2 weeks.
That's a Pete Carroll optimistic going for it. Such a brutal sack for Herbert to take. God, he's so bad.
Jerron Brown out a few weeks with a knee sprain, so he won't be a factor in the playoffs unless the Seahawks can go extremely deep. The Seahawks are hopeful that Malik Turner can clear concussion protocol on Thursday and give them a little more depth at wide receiver this week. And then lastly, Ethan Pusick was placed back on IR with the core muscle injury that caused him the San Francisco game. That's a bummer. And replaced on the roster by guard Kyle Fuller, who is called up from the practice squad and is presumably not the Kyle Fuller who plays quarterback.
Boise State legend.
On the Philadelphia side, a laundry list of injuries. I mean, we're not going to get into everyone who's missing from the start of the season because that's like half their offensive roster basically is out now. But some updates from this week. They on Sunday lost Pro Bowl right guard Brandon Brooks to a separated shoulder. That will require season-ending surgery.
And Brandon Brooks is the same guard who left the game against the Seahawks with anxiety.
Yeah, he had experienced symptoms of anxiety in that game, was unable to continue to play. I don't think it is, actually. No, I disagree with that. Running back Miles Sanders is day-to-day with an ankle injury. Peterson said Monday he expects both him and cornerback Avante Maddox, whose injury has not been disclosed, to play. Sanders did not participate in Wednesday's walkthrough, was one of two players on the active roster who was not practicing at all in that, the other one being wide receiver Nelson Agholor, who missed last week's game. So uncertain whether he'll be back. Peterson said Monday that tight end Zach Ertz, who is dealing with rib and kidney injuries, and there's a report that he suffered a kidney laceration, and right tackle Lane Johnson will be incorporated into practice this week. But as of Wednesday, they were improving, but not yet cleared for contact practice, though they were able to participate in that walkthrough. And then also same thing with running back Jordan Howard, who saw just one snap Sunday. He was active, but essentially just an emergency option for them at running back after he's missed several weeks. So the Eagles may be getting a little healthier, but also a huge loss for them in terms of Brandon Brooks.
Who, again, didn't play for much of that Seahawks.
He was badly missed in that game. They also were without Lane Johnson in that game. At that point, he was in concussion protocol, now he's dealing with, I believe, an ankle injury. But you know, the right side of their line gave up repeated pressure to the Seahawks defensive line, which is not something we've seen a lot of this season.
So a little over a month has passed since then. What is different about the Eagles now than the Eagles on November 24th?
I don't know that necessarily a ton is different about the Eagles.
I mean, they haven't gotten that much healthier.
No. I think the main thing is, I think that just that game, I think there's a lot of people are going to think, okay, this is going to go the same as that. And I think that game was such a huge outlier because of the turnovers. The Seahawks forced, you know, in that game, Carson Wentz threw two interceptions. He fumbled three times, losing two of them. It was an atypical performance by Carson Wentz. And then the Seahawks had turnovers as well in that game. A number of fumbles. I think that was both a CJ Procise and a Chris Carson fumble in that game. So, you know, that's just not things that
fumbles.
You would expect to.
That was the game where Carson fumbled twice in a row on two consecutive. Was that the Niners game? And then we eventually lost the second one. I think that was the Eagles game.
Oh, yeah. There was the fumble and then there was the botched snap.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that which was officially credited to Russell Wilson. Yeah, so there were a total of 7 turnovers in that game. And I just don't think that's a realistic expectation for this one. I think you're going to see a lot more offense. It also figures to be a better game weather-wise.
Yes.
That one was super windy, but I haven't checked the forecast for Philly lately, but it didn't seem like it was going to be nearly as bad an outlook in terms of it looked like it was going to be pretty sunny and reasonably warm for this time of year in Philadelphia.
Well, going into that game, we talked about the Eagles' secondary had looked pretty scary. And since then,
That is something that's changed. Yeah, I would agree with that. Because they came into that game, they had a run where 3 weeks in a row they had held opponents under 5 yards per attempt. Since then, they have not held a single opponent under 5 yards
per attempt. And who are these opponents also? I mean, like,
they've not been great opponents. They gave up 8.8 yards per attempt to Ryan Fitzpatrick.
Hey, well,
I mean,
he's the best of the quarterbacks that they've faced.
They gave up 9.0 yards per attempt to Washington. I'm not even sure. That was Haskins. Yeah, that's not great. So, and it was not a great Russell Wilson game, but it didn't necessarily feel like that was necessarily because of their secondary. I mean, I think one thing that's going to be an interesting matchup to watch in this is how much they plan to blitz this Seahawks line, especially with Dwayne Brown out. because that was something where the 49ers, if you looked at the next gen stats, had a lot of success blitzing him in last Sunday's game. But not traditionally something you want to do against Russell Wilson.
No, it'll be fascinating to see. I mean, I think to me the main difference, like the Seahawks are going to move the ball in this game. I don't think that the offense will play anywhere near as badly as they did in that previous game against Philadelphia. There were a lot of factors at play there. I mean, there were some drop passes. Like DK had a pass in the end zone in his hands that could have been a touchdown that he just didn't come up with. But at the same time, it is, have the Eagles learned from their mistakes the last time these two teams played? Because what the Eagles did played so perfectly into the Seahawks defense's goals, with they didn't push them downfield at all, they didn't test the secondary, they really didn't even throw passes to wide receivers. Everything was short.
I don't think that's going to change.
It was
like they just don't have the personnel for it.
It is the perfect offense. And honestly, like, this is a game where not having Michael Kendricks might matter. But they played into the Seahawks' goals of keeping their base defense on the field. And no offense to Zach Ertz and to Dallas Goedert, but neither of them is George Kittle.
No, they are not that. Nobody
no
is.
Human being on earth is George Kittle.
There's one of, they broke that mold.
He's one of one.
Gronk is the only thing close to him, and he's not walking through that door. And if he would be, he would be hosting a New Year's Eve party or something like that. Since the bye.
He would be hosting a New Year's Eve party.
That's accurate, don't you think?
Gronk is currently in Las Vegas.
Could be in Miami. I wouldn't rule that out.
There are only two cities that Gronk could be in at this moment.
He's still in Vegas. So since the bye, here are the targets for the Philadelphia Eagles. Zach Ertz has 60 in six games. He missed last week's game. Dallas Goedert has 55. Greg Ward has 40.
Greg Ward, I mean, when he was playing in that game against the Seahawks, it was just like this. He was brand new. Greg Ward's now their number one receiver.
They called him up before that game from the practice squad. He had literally never been thrown a pass in an NFL game. Since then, he is their number one receiver.
Yeah, he was on fantasy teams in the final last 2 weekends.
It's not like he's one and there's a 1A. Let's go through the rest of their targets.
Oh my God.
Miles Sanders has 36. Boston, the great Boston Scott, has 25. Their next wide receiver is Elshon Jeffery, who had 18 in two games and is now on IR. Then Nelson Agholor and J.J. Arcega-Whiteside had 15 apiece. That's it. Justin Herbert ran for another touchdown.
This is a long one, too.
Dude, he's really going for the dual threat angle for scouts. I think it's a good play for him.
He's like the new Josh Allen. He's like, look, I understand that I'm not accurate, but look, I can run too.
So Agholor may play in this game. I don't know how likely that is, but they just don't have the personnel to take deep shots. And yes, especially if their offensive line, we'll see how well that holds up with Brooks out and Lane Johnson at best coming back from injury.
So their offense has played well over these last 5 weeks, but the quality of defensive opponents has been incredibly bad. And I think that people, like, there's sort of a dialogue about Philadelphia as like,
I hate when we start a dialogue,
around, right?
Well, things are certainly not as bad as they were at that point. Like things were very bad for them in the Seahawks game in particular. But
I mean, that was really bad. I mean, honestly, like the loss to Miami felt like the new low,
the nadir.
And now Miami in the second half of the season was probably an average team in a lot of ways, but their defense was never average. Ryan Fitzpatrick got them to be an average team.
Yeah, here's the DVOA of the defenses they faced after the Seahawks. I mean, we could include the Seahawks for 18th. The Miami Dolphins are 32nd. The New York Football Giants are 27th. They
played
faced
them twice.
Yeah. The Washington Professional Football Team, wow, shockingly good on defense, 24th. And the best defense they have faced in that span, since the Seahawks, was Dallas at 19th in DVOA.
And they scored 17 points in that game.
They did.
So the Seahawks will be the best defense that they've played since the Seahawks.
Yes.
And this could be a Seahawks defense that's potentially getting Quandre Diggs back. Seems like they're getting a fully go Jadeveon Clowney. Most of the team is going to be back. Like, this is the perfect setup for the Seahawks defense.
Not entirely.
Okay.
All right. Well, first I'm going to give you one more stat on how bad the Eagles wide receivers are. and why this is a great matchup. They're leaders in terms of yards per target this season. No, actually, I guess, yeah, this is going to go back the other way. Greg Ward has not actually been particularly effective getting all those targets. He's only averaging 6.4 yards per target.
Oh, I mean, we saw what it was in the Seahawks game. It's quick outs and things like that.
Okay, so who are their top two players in terms of yards per target? It's not Zach Ertz or Dallas Goedert.
Yeah, it's Miles Sanders. We talked about this.
It's Miles Sanders at 8.1 and Boston Scott at 7.8. And the Seahawks need to be ready for running back screens in this game, which will be the first time they have ever been ready for a running back screen or
Miles
any
Sanders
sort of must
doesn't
direction.
Run screen routes, though. That's the thing.
It's plays that just wheel
he
routes.
He just runs routes. Okay. Miles Sanders.
That's also a bad thing for the Seahawks.
But if you look at where he's catching those passes, we did this the last time we talked about the Eagles.
Did we?
Yes. Miles Sanders is not catching short passes. He is one of the few running backs in the league who's catching passes down the field. And Miles Sanders is an issue, and having linebackers defend Miles Sanders is going to be an issue.
Which is where maybe it's not such a bad thing that, you know, well, it depends whether they're playing Cody Barton in place of Michael Kendricks or whether they actually go nickel.
Well, the thing was, they were able to get to Carson Wentz in the last game. Like, I don't know how many receptions he had. Miles Sanders was not really a factor in the last game against the Seahawks.
He was not, no.
So that could change completely. And if there's one player who's going, and maybe Boston Scott also, they love running their running backs out of the backfield on passing routes, though.
I don't know if this is really true. Miles Sanders averaged 1.8 yards before catch this season and 8.4 yards after catch. So it's a little deeper than Boston Scott, whose average target is behind the line of scrimmage because that's almost entirely screens.
It's way deeper. And check the notes.
Okay, I'll
by checking
pull
the notes,
up the notes.
I mean, listen to the podcast because it wasn't in the notes.
It wasn't in the notes. It was you mentioning it.
Yeah, we talked about it on the podcast. Go listen to it.
Okay, I'm probably not going to do that. But Boston Scott in particular must be running a lot of screens to have a minus 2.9 yards before catch.
Where are you seeing that?
This is on Pro Football Reference's advanced stats.
Huh. Maybe it was the yards per route run or something for Miles Sanders, or yards per catch or something.
Well, that's yards per target, which is good. Yes. We agree that his yards per target is good.
Anyway, these are the players who are going to beat the Seahawks.
Yeah. And that, and, you know, I don't know what kind of ability Greg Ward has as a rusher, but end arounds.
Oh, God.
The Seahawks still have never seen one of those coming.
I just woke up from a nightmare about end arounds.
completely reasonable.
So then on the offensive side of the ball, where does Philadelphia rank defensively?
Interesting. Boston, so no qualifying running back or no qualifying player in the league is negative a depth of target as Boston Scott.
Wow.
The lowest among qualifying players was Kenyon Drake at minus 1.6 yards per target before catch, or yards before catch, I guess. And Sanders is reasonably high for a running back, but not like hugely high, I guess I would say. Now, he is pretty high for a running back. I guess you are right about that. 1.8 is the standard for running back is pretty low. All right, what was your question?
Defensively, how should we expect the Seahawks offense to play against the Eagles defense?
I mean, I think one of the interesting things will be how much pressure they can get on Russell Wilson. They were fourth this season in ESPN's pass rush win rate, but just 13th in sack rate. And the six sacks they had against the Seahawks were their second most all season. And the other was 10 against Luke Falk, which, wow. With all due respect to Luke Falk and the week he didn't get to practice because Sam Darnold was practicing, even though he couldn't play, not really a fair comparison. So if they do that again, then I think the Seahawks are going to struggle to move the ball, as we've seen in the first half of the Niners game, in the Cardinals game, et cetera, et cetera. If they can actually protect Russell Wilson or they move to more of a quick passing game, then I think that there are some places to pick apart this Philadelphia secondary.
And what about against the run for Philadelphia?
That's where they have excelled this defense. They're number four in rush defense DVOA, and that was another place where the first matchup between these two teams was a little bit out of the ordinary. The Seahawks ran for 6.7 yards per attempt in that game, the most the Eagles have allowed this season. They held 11 of their 16 opponents under 4 yards per carry. So if the Seahawks go into this with the same game plan as they had last year in the wild card round of the playoffs at the NFC East champion, it's going to be a problem.
That's my question for you. What is, we have sort of now like a kind of a long host of the Seahawks going on the road in first round NFL playoff games, and they are if I recall correctly, 2-1 in those games.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much we can take away from the 2012 game against Washington at this point, but yes.
Huge. So it's the wins against Washington and Minnesota and a loss against the Cowboys.
Yes.
What is different about this team than last year's team? Is it just that Philadelphia is not as strong an opponent as the Cowboys were last year?
I think that's a positive for sure. Oh boy, they've learned something.
DVOA-wise, where do each of those teams rank?
Philadelphia ranks 11th this year. Last year.
Ah, man, I don't think it's that different. I'm a little surprised.
They are better than you'd think by DVOA for a team that was 6-7 or 5-7 before they went on a 4-game winning streak to end the season. Oh no, Dallas was 21st last year.
Oh my God, it's over.
I kept looking for them and I didn't find them. I mean, the Seahawks are a better team by DVOA than they were last year.
Okay.
But I mean, they played well enough in terms of passing to win that game.
It just feels like a good matchup. And that Cowboys game didn't feel like as good of a matchup. But I think that we had the same perspective this week going into that Cowboys game last year, which was the Seahawks are a better team. They will go in and win.
I think even though the Seahawks are favored this game, it's closer to 50-50.
Do you think that the value of home field advantage has changed in the last season?
I mean, we talked about this on the pod last week. There was no home field advantage at the, you know, points per game level in the NFL this year. I think clearly if you're an odds maker, you still want to project some home field advantage. 1 year is not a large enough sample size to say that it's gone completely. But it's also probably not as strong as it has been in the past.
Have the Seahawks ever played the Eagles in the playoffs? Or is this time number one?
I mean, yeah, I think this is the first time ever.
From my memory, I don't.
Because obviously they didn't play them when they were in the AFC, so it'd be only games that we remember.
It's a little crazy that these two teams have never played each other in the playoffs, right?
It is. I mean, they've both been good teams.
Yeah, that they've both been, like, around the playoffs for the last two decades for pretty extended chunks of time, and that it just never happened that they got each other.
Yeah, they were not good at the same time, or just didn't draw each other, or whatever it was.
So I'm just pretty fascinated for the game. I mean, it's one of those games that when we played them on November 24th, it didn't feel like this was going to be a playoff preview.
No, I mean, it felt like Philadelphia was done at that point.
And especially after losing, it really felt like Philadelphia was done. And then the week after that with the loss to Miami. But, you know, they've put it together just enough to get into the playoffs. They had the one huge win over Dallas. I think that Philadelphia is probably a little bit worse than DVOA is giving them credit for. I think the Seahawks are probably also a little bit worse than DVOA is giving them credit for.
I mean, both of these teams are so severely injured.
And it really depends on, is Quandre Diggs going to be out there? If you get a mostly healthy Seattle team, if you get a Seattle team that has most everybody, you know, who's not done for the year on this roster, I think this is a game that they should win.
The forecast, by the way, to go back to that, 41 degrees, a high, and partly cloudy.
There we go.
So it could get a little chilly in that one because it's going to be a 4:40 local kickoff.
Sorry, Russell Wilson can be cold.
He just can't be touched by rain.
Just don't let him get touched by rain.
Yeah.
Like I said, though, I think that this is the game that the Seahawks should win in the same way that they should have won against Dallas last year. And a real question will be, are they going to stand in their own way? Are they going to run good offense? Are they going to compete in this game at the highest level?
Are they going to go for fourth downs? Are they going to inexplicably get delay of game penalties on the goal line? There's a lot of ways they could beat themselves.
I'm going to go ahead and predict that that's not going to happen again. But if they do beat themselves, the way that they will beat themselves is by both not by running too much. I hate the term stick with the run or get back to the run as if the run is like base. Like that's where you should be or whatever.
Well, it's the same thing as chasing points because the base is you should take 1 point as opposed to making the
base
case
is getting
for it.
Less points.
Yes.
That's my least favorite commentator term is get back to the run. As it's like, You go into every team, goes into every game wanting to run every single play. And then they're like, oh, crap, the run's not working. Let's start passing.
I mean, if you go back in the entire history of football, the forward pass didn't exist at one point. So you yes. are truly getting back to the run.
It's like sort of like...
Wait, did I tell you the did I tell you the story about Mom when she was watching the game here on Sunday night?
Oh, God.
She tells me, no, this is actually a legitimately good one. It seems like the Seahawks don't pass as much as other teams. Is that true?
Wow.
Yeah, it was an astute comment.
Jan, coming through. But yeah, it's like one of those things, like we're genetically, like we've been genetically trained for generations to think that run is the base thing, like being scared of snakes. That's all commentators. Dating back hundreds of years because the pass is new.
In Moneyball, I forget who made this reference. Someone referred to it as the atavistic need to run.
Uh-huh.
And that's why people wanted them to play small ball in the playoffs. And so I think that also fits here. It's out of it. Like running is more a human instinct than throwing things is.
I guess that's kind of true. You should talk to my children whenever they get to a beach, because let me just say,
that's pretty
throwing things
for them.
Is their base instinct. Every single one of them.
But I'm pretty sure I heard that yesterday one of them tried to run into the Puget Sound. So yeah, that is too. It was the same one who tried to run into the bowling lane when we went bowling on Saturday.
Atavistic need to bowl yourself.
The human biological
need to run down a bowling lane is more natural than the idea of throwing a ball at the pins. Oh my God. That really explains commentators. It's like he had to get back to the run, and that by that he meant himself down the bowling lane. Running into Puget Sound.
So chances of victory.
Oh my God. I think that the Seahawks have... I can't even believe your chance of victory last week. And that we almost won, too.
It was an emotional ballot.
It was a vote of passion.
I voted with my heart. It turned out that Marshawn Lynch didn't have quite the galvanizing effect on the crowd that I was hoping.
I mean, the crowd was loud, but like there were also a solid 20% 49ers fans.
I would have guessed higher than that from the shots on TV.
So I'm saying that understanding that my bias is to say that there were more because you don't see that many. Does that make sense? The red stands out more than the blue and green do.
Yeah.
So I'm saying that, like, I'm regressing my initial perspective. And I think that also where the 49ers fans are probably more visible.
Ooh. There's a lot of them, like, on the sidelines.
Well, I mean, they stand right... There's so many of them right behind the 49ers bench.
Right.
I think there is a 60% chance of the Seahawks winning. 58% chance.
I'm going 50-50. Like I said, I think that... The Eagles haven't been hurt as much by their injuries as you would think. And though the Seahawks are a better team on a neutral
what
site,
does that mean,
I
though?
Do think Eagles...
Like, what does that mean, not being hurt by their injuries? Because they're playing against the Giants.
But I'm telling you that when I went and evaluated
this
last week...
We're both watching the Rose Bowl.
That's exciting. You're ahead on your broadcast than I am, I think.
It's a hell of a tackle on that punt for Oregon.
It was quite a tackle. When you look at their performance over the past six games or over the past seven games as compared to the rest of the season, it's not that different. That's what I mean.
Okay.
Even when you account for the opponents that they've
faced.
Have
we gotten a defensive DVOA or EPA per play or whatever from the Seahawks with and without Quandre Diggs?
I haven't seen that. I would like to see it.
Can you do that?
No.
Like you don't possess the skills to do it or you just don't want to?
I don't possess the information to do it.
Okay.
Oh, like yards per play? I guess yards per play I could do. But I would want an opponent adjust probably.
Well, and also, like, I mean, I do think that...
I think we'll hope that appears in the Football Outsiders preview by the end of the week.
The turnovers, have they...
Oh, they've completely got away since Quandre Diggs got hurt.
Okay. Like, it's real. The turnovers with Quandre Diggs are real.
It has actually happened. I don't know that you can attribute the change in turnover rate strictly to Quandre Diggs because there's a lot of randomness in that and splits happen.
Sure. And I mean, again, they've been playing against good quarterbacks too. And our terrible defense leaves receivers wide, wide open whenever we play against Sean McVay or Kyle Shanahan. So
I may actually be way ahead of you, as it turns out. I'm now considering that possibility. Yeah.
OPI. I feel good about this one. I like the time. I like playing on Sunday afternoon versus playing. I mean, the Seahawks are playing on their, like.
No, that was something we talked about in the preview before the last Philly game, is that historically the downside to playing on the East Coast is primarily about the 10 a.m. games. It's not as bad a thing if you play in the late games, and then it's actually a benefit to the road team to play the in true night game.
The Seahawks are playing at basically the time they start most of their games.
That is correct.
And when their bodies should be peaking, more or less, right? And, like, it probably won't be a huge factor, but even just, like, Saturday night in Dallas is not easy to win, right?
I suppose.
Like, I'm sorry, but that stage is not an easy stage to go into and win. If it would have been Sunday morning in Dallas, it's different. But Saturday night in Dallas is a hard game to win. I like Sunday way better.
Sure.
Anyway, I guess as Quandre Diggs would say, we'll see.
Wow, what a terrific transition. We're going to wrap up this week with an annual tradition of ours, and that's watching the Oregon-Wisconsin Rose Bowl. And that not being an interception probably for Oregon, but maybe it was. Yeah, juggling it. But that's going back and revisiting the NFL's over-under lines that we did at the start of the season. Ooh, so you went and listened to this podcast, correct?
I listened to most of it. And just to punish myself. No, because it's fun. When you just look at the numbers raw, you don't quite get the full story of what our conversation was.
Right, and I'm hoping you can provide that context. Since I just went back and updated the spreadsheet I have for this season. We start.
And I guess if we can summarize how we've done in the past, do you have the exact numbers?
I do somewhere.
To summarize how we've done in the past, I do terrible with this. You do slightly better. And whomever our guest is, Mina Kimes, Ben Baldwin, or whoever, does way better.
Danny Kelly. Not Mina.
Sorry.
We need to have back on the pod. We have not had Danny on the pod in way too long.
Yeah, one of the various traitors.
Yeah.
Ben's a traitor because his child is wearing a Ravens hat.
Can you blame him?
But though the guests always do way better than we do. So this year...
We got rid of the guest.
You got to even the playing field here a little bit.
That's a little thing called strategy. Let's start with the Arizona Cardinals, who had a line of 5 wins this season. We both went over. The result instead was a push.
Okay.
They won 5 games with a tie. So it's effectively 5.5 the standings, but sadly that does not count when you're doing over-unders. It is just their record.
And they really felt like more than a 5-win team.
They did.
Maybe that's because I recently saw them play the Seahawks.
That could be it. Next up, the Atlanta Falcons had a line this season of 8.5 wins. I went under, you went over, and they, of course, went under, struggling much of the early part of the season before a late rally got them to 7-9 and saved Dan Quinn's job.
I'll forever believe in you, Matty Ice.
The Baltimore Ravens, a line of 8 wins. Wait, I have it down. You down as an over here.
Let's stick with that.
You didn't say over?
I'm pretty sure listening to the podcast, I said under. But, you know, like the official stats, I don't want to, you know.
You don't want to mess with that?
Yeah.
They went over, as it turned out. So officially, we both got that.
There we go. Great.
The Buffalo.
Don't listen to the podcast.
Buffalo Bills, a line of 7 wins. You went under. I went over on this one. Buffalo finished 10-6 and the number 5 seed in the NFC in the AFC. The Carolina Panthers, a line of 8 wins. We both liked the over here as they bounced back from their disappointing season. I remember being very, very taken by what I saw of the Carolina Panthers on All or Nothing, the Amazon series about their season. It turned out that Cam Newton was not back healthy, and that Kyle Allen was not as good a quarterback as him, and they finished 5-11 and fired Ron Rivera.
So the
both got that one wrong.
The quarterback injury teams, which I would say, knock on wood this year, there weren't that many devastating quarterback injuries.
Yeah, the injuries were probably more to lesser quarterbacks.
I mean, there were bad quarterback injuries to various players, but like Last season, it felt like there was a good chunk of the NFL who missed time. And, you know, Mahomes missed time this year. But, like, as
but
far as...
But it only ended up being, like, 2 weeks, right? Or 3 weeks, maybe?
Season-ending injuries. It feels like Roethlisberger and Cam Newton were the only real huge ones.
Drew Brees missed time, but was able to come back. It didn't ultimately affect their
and,
season.
You know, maybe Nick Foles, but, you know, who knows?
Well, they had a much better winning percentage with Gardner Minshew at quarterback than
I guess Stafford. But it felt like it was sort of like...
But against Stafford, they were already out of it.
The second or third tier of quarterbacks who were getting injured.
Chicago Bears had a line of 9 wins coming off their NFC North Championship in 2018. We both snuffed this out and picked the under. Chicago finished 8-8. It was actually not as clear-cut as one would have hoped.
Well, Vegas knew that they were going to be a big
regression team. Right, it was a relatively low line. Cincinnati had a line of 6 wins... I took the over. You took the under and made it a lock for you.
And I said on that podcast, I think that the Bengals are the worst team in the NFL.
Before which, you reversed course after you saw them play one time against the Seattle Seahawks base defense.
You know what? Like I'm saying, like I said to you before, if the NFL season was 32 games long, the Bengals don't get the first pick in the draft.
I don't think so, but they... They still would not probably have gotten to the 12 wins they would have needed to hit the open, both of these combined, or to push even.
I said they were the worst team in the NFL, though, and that included the Dolphins. So
that was a pretty ballsy choice. Cleveland Browns had a line of 9 wins, and you saw fit to take the over. You were riding that Baker Mayfield hype train. OBJ, all these weapons, Jarvis Landry. I took the under here. I correctly felt that there was too much hype, although I would not have predicted a 6-10 season for Cleveland.
It still doesn't make sense. Like, Cleveland should have been better.
The Dallas Cowboys had a line of 9 wins. I went under. You took the over. I think your process was better. Dallas was one of the NFL's best teams, but they could not win a close game to save their lives, and it went 8-8. Denver Broncos had a line of 7 wins. I went under, you went over. They won precisely 7 games for our second push. An annoying number of even numbers resulted in 2 pushes this year. Detroit with a line of 6.5. And this is where things went awry. You took the under. I felt based on their strong Football Outsiders projection for an average of 8.3 wins that not only did I like the over, I liked it as my lock for this year.
Just saying to yourself that the Detroit Lions would be a lock for anything.
I mean, I just thought they just needed to win 7 games, but they didn't. They won 3.
What pick did they?
They don't have as good of a pick as the Washington professional football team because they've got that tie in there. So they're the 3rd pick.
Like, great. That's still a pretty good pick.
That is still
but,
a very
but if,
good pick.
But if I would have told you that the Lions, your lock for an over, would have gotten a worse draft pick than the Dolphins this year... I mean, pretty much anybody after those first couple of weeks, like the Dolphins seemed like a lock to get the number one pick.
They did.
For the first at least month of the season.
Or at the very least for it to come down to that Miami-Cincinnati game, which ultimately didn't really matter, I think. Green Bay, a line of 9 wins. For some reason, we both went under here. We didn't realize that the Packers are just always inexplicably good. They went 13-3, won the NFC North. We were very off on that. Houston Texans, a line of 8.5 wins. We both liked the over. We were both correct. They won 10 games in the AFC South as Oregon.
I was going to say, don't score that touchdown.
Don't know why you went out of bounds, but Wisconsin's out of timeouts. So it's over.
It doesn't matter. Yeah.
Indianapolis, a line of 7.5 wins after the Andrew Luck injury. We both liked the under here. That was looking dicey for a period of time early in the season, and in fact was in jeopardy all the way up until the finale, but they lost that meaningless finale and therefore finished with 7 wins and an under, so we got the victory there. Jacksonville, a line of 8 wins in the AFC South. I had the under. You had the over. Big on Nick Foles, clearly.
Ugh.
They won 6 games.
I also love Josh Allen, which I feel like we didn't hear his name at all. I mean, we heard Josh Allen's name, but we didn't hear Josh Allen's name.
That's true. The Kansas City Chiefs had a line of 10.5 wins coming off their appearance in the AFC Championship game. For some reason, I liked the under here, just because I guess regression to the mean. You took the over, and despite being without Patrick Mahomes for 3 games due to injuries, they still went 12-4 and won the AFC West, so I was way off on that one. The LA Chargers, we both saw, is a regression candidate after they won 12 games in 2018. They had a line of 10. We both went under. The LA Chargers went 5-11, hit half of their under, half of their line. The LA Rams had a line of 10 wins. We both, as pessimistic Seahawks fans, liked the over for them. They instead won 9 games and went under. Miami Dolphins had the league's lowest line at 4.5 wins.
Wow, and they got to over?
They got to over. We both went under. We thought that was still too many for the Dolphins at 4.5. But Sunday's win in New England was their fifth of the season, pushed them to an over.
Oh, man. I mean, they're obviously, like, the Dolphins weren't a playoff team, but it's really interesting to show that nothing is a lock in the NFL and that the NFL season is very long. Whatever you think you know in September, you might not know by December.
That's very true. True in all sports, but particularly in the NFL.
But also for the Patriots, at some point in the season, which we can talk about them in a second, but like the Patriots seemed like they were guaranteed to get at least a bye in the AFC.
Yes.
And it took a lot of wins to get a bye in the AFC because there were some excellent teams. But like them losing to the Dolphins in week 17 to lose their bye was, at some point in the season, that looked like when it happened, it was shocking, but it wasn't that shocking. But if you would have told us that in September, it would have been the most shocking thing.
Yep. Minnesota Vikings, a line of 9 wins. I went under, you went over. I did not see the Kirk Cousins renaissance coming. The Minnesota Vikings won 10 games and earned a wild card. They won 10 games despite playing all their backups against Chicago in week 17. New England had a line of 11.5 wins. We both thought that was too high, went for the under. They, of course, won 12 games and against an extraordinarily easy schedule. Yeah,
they had at least 8 just gimme games.
New Orleans, a line of 10 wins. I liked the over, you liked the under. Despite that Drew Brees injury we mentioned, they went 13-3 to claim the number 3 seed in the NFC. It took a lot of wins to get the bye in the NFC, is what you actually meant. New York Giants had a line of 5.5 wins. We both liked the over here, thought that they would improve after last season. Instead, it was dimes time after just 2 weeks, and that did not translate into a lot of victories. They went 4-12 and hit the under. New York Jets, a line of 7.5 wins.
God, I know I went over on this today.
No, you went under. I went over.
Oh, hello.
The Jets went, it's closer than you think. They went 7-9. I don't know how that's possible. They lost all those 9 games by like 25 points each.
It's funny because they went 7-9 and the Dolphins went 5-11. But the Jets feel like a shit show, and Adam Gase feels like one of the worst coaches in the league. But Brian Flores feels like a hot young coach. Granted, they're different rosters.
They're very different rosters.
And set up differently, but it's like...
One of those teams went out and paid a running back a bunch of money last summer. The other team traded for 2 first-round picks next year.
Man, look at the Dolphins.
Yeah, they're spry. The Oakland Raiders had a line of 6 wins. We both liked the over. High on the hard knocks.
They got there, right?
They did. They went 7-9 despite slumping to finish the season. Philadelphia Eagles had a line of 10 wins. We both liked the under here. We were both correct, as even that late 4-game winning streak got them only to 9-7. Pittsburgh Steelers.
That was a ridiculous over-under for Philadelphia.
I mean, they were like a Super Bowl favorite coming into the year.
I don't really
understand. There was so much hype about their offensive and defensive line, and their offensive line was only okay. It was pretty much middle of the pack in pass block win rate. I think Mina may have picked them as her Super Bowl.
I mean, obviously, injuries affected Philadelphia quite a bit. And the Deshaun still Jackson injury. Games. So, I don't know, maybe. But just that has to be one of the higher over-unders for any team.
It was like 4th, I guess. Or 3rd. They were behind Kansas City and New England and tied with New Orleans.
Yeah, I don't know. Preseason, to me, I didn't have the expectation that Philadelphia was the.
Well, that's why we both took the under.
Yeah.
Pittsburgh had a line of 9 wins. We both took the over on that. Roethlisberger's injury.
Process was good here, though, right? Did they get to 8-8?
They did get it to 8-8. Lost their finale to the Baltimore Ravens, who were starting their backups.
But do you think that Ben Roethlisberger versus Duck Hodges and Mason Rudolph is worth 2 wins?
Probably.
Pretty clearly is.
No, we also didn't see their defense becoming as dominant as it was after the addition of Minkah Fitzpatrick. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. They were 0-2. They started poorly with Roethlisberger.
I told you in this podcast, fantasy process. Look, fantasy is a numbers game. You want to take a lot of players that you like and hope that some of those players end up being good.
It'd be weird if you took fewer players than other people in the draft.
But it's like, okay, so my fantasy process is basically like take a bunch of high upside players.
Uh-huh.
I don't want medium upside players. I don't want average players.
You don't want Larry Fitzgerald.
Yeah, which I actually drafted in multiple leagues.
I did too.
I drafted him in at least two out of three leagues.
I don't think their pace ended up being as extreme as we hoped it would be based on the preseason.
No, and having Christian Kirk on my roster all year was not fun. But except for the
better,
one.
Better than having AJ Green on your roster nearly all year. In two leagues. Still waiting for him to come back any day now. He's going to be back from that ankle injury.
There are a lot of backup running backs who I just waited out forever and they never play. Like Alexander Mattison, I swear to God, I waited out that Dalvin Cook injury forever. And then Alexander Mattison got hurt the same week. But I told you on this podcast that I thought that Juju Smith-Schuster would lead the NFL in receiving yards.
Oh, that did not come to pass.
Spoiler alert. That did not happen.
Narrator. San Francisco had a line of 8 wins. We both liked the under here. They were too hyped over the offseason. Obviously, they were coming off that 4-win season. They went 13-3 and won.
And Simmons mentioned this when they were looking back at the season also, and they were both like, it was the one preseason game where Jimmy Garoppolo threw like 5 picks on 5 passes.
And also the practice where he kept throwing interceptions.
But what we didn't realize, well, I guess this wouldn't have mattered in the preseason game. The practice, he was playing against the Niners defense.
Yeah, that turns out to be way better than anyone realized.
And also having Sherman as sort of like an older defender healthy. I mean, Seahawks didn't even really look Richard Sherman's way this last weekend.
They know.
Right? Like he's reached the level. He's the same player that he was in Seattle in his prime.
I don't know if he's quite, but he's like 95%.
He's very close. And so having that back there where you can eliminate half the field can make a lot of the rest of your defense look really good.
Still didn't work with Akello Witherspoon with Jaquiski Tart out on Sunday. You saw that Witherspoon got benched by the end of the game, right?
Did he really?
Yeah, they kept showing him on the sidelines during that final drive.
And Nick Bosa as a rookie, like, I mean, I think everybody expected Nick Bosa to be good, but as a rookie, he was probably even better than we expected. And
I think more the rest of the defensive line, like the contributions they got from, you know, the interior pressure. They got, like, multiple guys with 8-plus sacks.
What's that?
Yeah, that's a thing that can happen.
They had multiple guys with 8-plus sacks divided by 3.
Like combined among them?
Seahawks sack leader was Rasheem Green. Oh my God.
Speaking of the Seahawks, they had a line of 8.5 wins. We both liked the over. They indeed won 11 games. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers had a line of 6.5 wins. Somehow I went under this.
Wow.
Did I not believe in the Jameis Bruce Arians combination that has produced some? Look, I feel bad for Jameis, but this is amazing content.
And I went over.
You went over, and you got that correct, as they went 7-9.
You just don't bet against Bruce Arians.
It's a good choice. The Tennessee Titans had a line of 7.5 wins. We both liked the over here because we knew that Ryan Tannehill would come in midseason and transform them into the dominant offense.
Both loved Ryan Tannehill.
They, in fact, won 10 games or 9 games to win the AFC second wild card. The Washington professional football team had a line of 5.5 wins. We both took the over here. They went 3-13.
Oof.
They are very bad at football. I mean, this is why it's hard, because, you know, they have a line of 5.5, and that seems like, oh, that's too low. Any competent team can win at least 6 games. Miami has a line of 4.5, and you're like, that's too high. They're so bad. And you lose both of those somehow. But, all right, final tally. So you were under the impression that I beat you again. You were wrong.
Wow.
It was a draw.
Oh.
It was a fabulous
play. Everybody wins.
We both went 16-14-2 with the 2 pushes this year. And we both ended up making money.
Really?
I made back 2.2% return on my investment, and you made a 1% return on your investment. So not losing. It was almost as good as putting that money in the bank for 3 months. I think it was actually better than that, but
or having to sweat it out for a Dolphins Week 17 victory. No, that actually was bad for us.
It was bad. We could have had more. It was a strangely poor year for Football Outsiders, which went 12-18 on the year.
Wow.
Yeah, so
Football Outsiders went 12-18?
Yeah, so it was a good thing that I did well on the ones where I only strayed from them 6 times, but on those I went 4-2.
What do you think it was about Football Outsiders this year?
I don't know. I mean, I think this was Aaron Schatz talked about this in their year-end DVOA. There was a less year-to-year carryover, particularly offensively, than you typically see. So
really? Like, that was probably a big
factor in it. Well, like, teams that were good in 2018 were not as good in 2018 offensively as they typically are. Yeah. So that was a big factor.
I'm trying to think of an example of who that would be.
I mean, he pointed – one interesting thing he noted is that the offensive and defensive, there was more than if you looked at the overall – there was more turnover than if you looked at the overall, because there were some teams that last year they were good on offense and bad on defense and vice versa. Uh-huh. And then this year they just flipped.
They just flipped.
Like, Dallas was really good defensively last year. That kind of carried them. This year they were amazing offensively. So they were about the same quality overall. Well, I guess they weren't, based on what we talked about earlier in the podcast. They were way better.
A lot better.
But
didn't make the playoffs.
Yeah.
It was...
But they were more similar at the team level than they were at the aggregate, at the individual unit level.
It felt like just empirically that it was like the first half, the first 8-9 weeks, that there were these clear haves and have-nots in a lot of ways. And then the second half of the season that really flipped.
Yeah.
It yeah, that's felt probably like true. Some of the teams who in the beginning of the season seemed totally incompetent ended up being like fairly solid teams who could knock somebody off. And then, or like Carolina winning those games at the beginning of the year. How did that happen? The like win streak that they had under Kyle Allen. And then it just.
Well, they had an MVP candidate running back.
Yeah. And then he just stopped being an MVP candidate.
And then it turned out that running backs are not that valuable.
I thought in general, just thinking of this, I know that I mentioned this on the post 49ers podcast. You're going to hate hearing this as a basketball fan. This was an excellent NFL season. I mean, right? Like,
I'm not against the NFL. I mean, I am against the NFL for various reasons, but I'm not against the NFL because of the play.
It's just
the play is entertaining.
There's still like nothing compares to an NFL Sunday, and it felt like we had some very good NFL Sundays this year. Maybe it's just because the Seahawks were better than we expected or whatever, why it felt better. But it did sort of feel like the injuries
were... Well, there's a lot of fun stars in the league right now.
The injuries weren't too devastating.
Young quarterbacks, Lamar, Mahomes... Russell Wilson is a young quarterback. You know, Deshaun.
Like, the youth movement.
Ryan Fitzpatrick.
Yeah. The youth movement at quarterback, Duck Hodges.
wait, hold on. I was naming good quarterbacks who aren't young. You're naming bad quarterbacks, sir.
But the youth movement at quarterback that has happened in the last 3 or 4 years.
And that's why it's exciting to see a dual threat quarterback like Justin Herbert come along to be part of this next year.
All of the top NFL draft prospects being able to run and pass. You've got Jacob Eason. You've got Justin Herbert out there.
You know,
look, we're going to make sure that the NFL gets back to the days of old of tall white men throwing passes way over the receivers' heads.
I got to say, when Eason ran against Colorado, it was a lot faster than I expected. I had drunk a lot tailgating that night.
He galloped.
It was impressive.
He thought he was going to run right into the crowd.
The problem is more his inability to play in a crowd than it is athleticism per se.
Yeah, that's he'll have clean pockets every single pass in the NFL. but the receiver generation.
I can't wait to talk about Jacob Eason's NFL draft stock.
The quarterbacks that you were talking about in that generation, it's like we're replacing a generation of Phil Rivers, Ben Roethlisberger. Like, this was the end of the Phil Rivers, Ben Roethlisberger, Eli Manning generation of quarterbacks.
I mean, you will not say anything negative about Phil Rivers, good sir.
But it's just like those quarterbacks are aging out and being replaced as stars with Deshaun Watson and Pat Mahomes and Lamar Jackson. Like,
I like you didn't put Brady in the aging out list.
Well, I mean, who knows? Brady's still in the playoffs. Like, Ben Roethlisberger and Eli Manning didn't play, and Phil Rivers went 5-11.
That's true.
Like,
Eli Manning did play. He had to get his record back to 500 career.
It was pretty incredible. But it just felt like there were a lot of good storylines throughout the NFL this year. We didn't have any like particularly devastating injuries. The NFL, this is going to sound crazy.
Knock on wood for that one.
It felt like, in general, it was a slightly safer game this year than it has in the past. And this might not be borne out by actual injuries or whatever, but it was just like, and maybe the NFL just got lucky. There weren't any like massively terrible storylines that happened throughout the season, right? Like there was nothing that happened this year. Maybe I'm forgetting something massive where it was just like, I guess Antonio Brown sort of was that, but it felt like it was kind of just gone.
That went away pretty quickly. Antonio Brown himself did not go away.
The Kaepernick situation wasn't great. But it was just like, it was an enjoyable NFL season. Like,
the NFL managed to keep most of the discussion this year about the play on the field and the terrible refereeing.
Yep, and the terrible refereeing. They even sort of, like, despite the fact what happened with the Seahawks, they massively overreacted about pass interference calls, and that ended up sort of evening out. You know, like, it's if that Hollister play would have been reviewed, if it would have happened outside of 2 minutes, I do feel pretty confident that they would have overturned it if they took a look at it.
The good news is that definitely there will not be any terrible calls involving pass interference replay during the playoffs that come back to haunt the league.
But also, it's a fun group of playoff teams, too. Like, the worst quarterback in the playoffs is probably Josh Allen.
Yes.
You know, like, the stage is set for some pretty fun. You could have the Patriots-Chiefs in the second round, followed by Chiefs-Ravens AFC Championship. Right? Like, that would be pretty good. Even having Aaron Rodgers in the mix as the heel for Seahawks Twitter, like, in the playoffs. Like, it's kind of fun.
I mean, if Aaron Rodgers has a great game that's not against the Seahawks, it will be fun to see Ben's mentions go on fire.
Oh, yeah. What if he goes in there and just roasts the 49ers?
I mean,
you could have a 49ers-Packers NFC Championship game.
The one thing
a rematch of that very, very close game that they played earlier this year.
It was highly competitive on both sides. The Seahawks, if they had won on Sunday and been the 3 seed, would have been looking at a trip to Green Bay had they won. So I got to say, maybe not the worst fate for them instead to play at Philadelphia. And then if they win that, most likely will play at San Francisco.
We want San Francisco. Win this game, Pete. Give us San Francisco.
The rubber for match. You need the rubber match and bring back Chase McLaughlin.
Yeah. Find a way to injure Robbie Gould again.
I mean, I don't need him to be injured. Just, like, you know, maybe he retires. He's very old.
Andrew Luck, unexpected retiring.
He goes back to the Chicago Bears midseason. That can happen, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
The Bears need a kicker.
They sure do. On that note.
Thanks again for listening with us in all of 2019. You know, you can expect the usual from the Peloton Cast in 2020, just permanent brackets.
I mean, we're going to have some extended brackets this year.
Brackets are coming in soon and hot.
They could be coming next week.
Wow, could they?
I mean, we're not going to start it, but we could start talking about it next week.
Wow.
I was going to say something. Oh, if you haven't already, definitely listen to our 2019 and Seattle Sports Year and Decade in Review, and then check out our 2020 bold predictions, because one of them already came true. I got the Travis Homer starting a game. Definitely did not think it was going to be, because the two starting running backs ahead of him on the depth chart got injured 3 days later, but, you know, a win's a win. It's between podcasts. It doesn't have to be in calendar 2020. I'm taking credit.
But did he start? Marshawn Lynch was announced as the starter.
When they opened the game, Travis Homer was on the field. That's what makes you the starter. He also played way more snaps.
Travis Homer's awesome.
Travis Homer's really good. And, you know, we never talked about this in the postgame pod. George Fant, like, not an issue at all blocking Nick Bosa throughout that game. Like, George Fant more than held his own.
George Fant's good.
Yeah. But it was a loss to not have him as a receiving option.
Mm-hmm. I definitely would have thrown him.
On that note.
All right. Thanks for listening.
Bye. There.
But it's just like, we need to deal with a very different beast in the Rose Bowl than Oregon has to deal with.
That's accurate.
And so it's like, if Oregon wins or whatever, like, people are going to look at it like, oh, they won the Rose Bowl and the Huskies didn't, but not look at the quality of the
When opponent. You say people, you mean Oregon fans. I don't know that anyone else is really thinking about it in those terms.
Do you think anybody actually pays attention to the results of bowl games outside of trying to make narrative arcs about how bad or good conferences are?
That's it, yes. And unfortunately, the Pac-12...
and or Jim Harbaugh.
Aside from the Huskies' dominant win over Boise State... has not been a great bowl season for the Pac-12. Arizona State got the win yesterday in the Sun Bowl.
Oh, did they? We had Cal. They did. So if Oregon wins, this is basically like they'll go 500.
Okay. The losses were pretty unimpressive.
Pretty unimpressive losses?
Yeah, Utah got blown out by Texas.
That's what the Pac-12 is all
the
about.
The Cougs who were struggled, could not Air stop Force Air Force's option attack.
Quite good, I think.
I do think that Oregon State should run the option.
Oh, really?
That's my tech. I mean, Oregon State is doing well offensively now, but just like a school that can't recruit well, you should run the option, which they did in the 90s, and it did not go super great, as
you
it
think
turns
every
out.
Every school that, I mean, I agree with that.
It's Jerry Pettibone, I believe, was the coach.
It's like Wazoo running the air raid or whatever. Just like schools who aren't going to recruit.
You should just do something different.
Some fun shit.
It's the Moneyball Billy Beane philosophy. If we do the same thing as the Red Sox and the A's, we're going to lose to the Red Sox and the A's every time.
Yeah. Oregon State was like pretty good for a solid decade and a half or so.
Yes.
So I don't... Oregon State has had talent go through it.
They have.
But I like it.
But it's a tough situation to feel like I need for the Pac-12 for Oregon to win the Rose Bowl. It's not great.
You wish that the rest of the Pac-12 would have done so well that we could sacrifice Oregon in the Rose
Bowl? Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, boy.